That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
I was going to Whole Foods a lot and just reinforced, like, I'm seeing no Latino brands on the shelf, none. Where are the Latino beauty brands? I can think outside of the box, and I can actually think bigger, and this might be the opportunity to go and build something. The mission was to build a premium Latina brand that would disrupt the Eurocentric beauty space, which has been dominated by Western European brands. All of us have been conditioned to believe if it's French, it's more worthy of a higher price tag, it's more expensive, it's a higher quality. And if it's Mexican, it should be cheap. There's plenty of soap in the world, you know what I mean? But our brand and what we stand for, we have a brand. A brand is not a product, a brand is a feeling.
What do you do after the company you work for implodes, you have student loans, credit card debt, a daughter, and you need to make ends meet fast? For San Diego native Sandra Velasquez, the answer was starting her own company. Sandra spent 14 years as lead singer and band leader for Pistolera, a band that toured internationally and even had its own NPR Tiny Desk concert. When the band fizzled out and her day job ended abruptly, Sandra was forced to look elsewhere for work. The answer found her when she was visiting her parents' home in San Diego and she saw a prickly pear cactus, or a nopal cactus, growing outside a window. That would become the inspiration for Nopalera, a luxury bath and body company that uses the nopal to make clean products like botanical bars, moisturizers, and soaps. Today, Nopalera is sold at over 400 retailers, including Nordstrom and Free People. Sandra Velasquez joins Business School today to tell us why she launched a soap company when she herself was not obsessed with soaps, how she managed to build her business off of credit cards, how she ended up on Shark Tank, and why she decided to walk away from the shark's offers. Plus, she answers questions from small businesses around the country. I'm journalist Fernando Hurtado, and on Business School, I'm on a mission to map one of the fastest growing groups of entrepreneurs in the United States, Latinos. We're tracking how they got started, found success, and the most important lessons they've learned along the way. And remember, business school is expensive. Business school is free. Sandra, welcome to Business School. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
So Sandra, I know you are officially our first guest that we've had on Business School that has also had an NPR Tiny Desk concert. So what was more nerve-wracking, performing internationally live in front of audiences or pitching to sharks on Shark Tank?
I would say pitching to sharks on Shark Tank, because when you're on stage, the audience is far away from you, usually. And when you're in the tank, you're in a quiet tank. It's dead quiet. It's a sound stage, and five people are just staring at you.
So you're used to performing in front of crowds of thousands of people, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. And you used to be the band leader and lead vocalist for Pistolera, which you've described as a dance party at the Brooklyn-Mexico border. I'm curious, what was your parents' reaction when you told them you wanted to dedicate yourself fully to music after college?
You know, my father is an artist, so I always had my parents' support. I think that they were very proud that I was proud of my culture, because they really made an effort to really instill that in me from a young age. And I used Pistolera as a platform to tell our stories, to celebrate our culture, and I sang in Spanish. So they were proud. And I always had a day job for health insurance, so they were fine.
And speaking of health insurance, one of our taglines for this show is, you know, they say other people's money is none of your business, and I say it's all of our business. I'm not going to ask you too many money questions, but I am curious, how did you make ends meet? Like, were you able to live off of the music, or was your day job really kind of paying all the bills?
So I live in New York, which is, you have to have five jobs to survive in New York. And I lived off of both. So it was always good to have the day job, because that was a weekly paycheck. Whereas with music, if you're making an album, you're in the studio, you're paying money, you're not making any money because you're building, right? And then you go out on tour and then you make the money, you know, you're playing the show, selling the merch, etc. So it was good to have that day job as like just the steady, you know, it's always there. It wasn't very much because I never wanted to have a stressful day job so that I could, you know, dedicate my energy and time to music. But it did help. So there were times where the music was paying the bills. There were times where the day job was paying the bills. So it was good to have both.
And what was that day job that you held at Barnard College?
For 15 years, I was the office administrator for the dance department at Columbia University. So it kind of fell into my lap. I actually found the job in the back of the New York Times, and it just said arts job. And I applied, and it turned out to be for the dance department at Columbia.
So eventually, though, you decide to leave that job at Columbia and you enter a sales job.
I fully leaped out of Columbia because it, for me, was an opportunity to get out of the Upper West Side, which is where Columbia University is. And I live in Brooklyn. So it was a very long commute every single day, multiple trains in each direction. And this opportunity fell into my lap to join a startup in the CPG space. I had never worked in CPG before. It was far outside of my comfort zone or my knowledge, but I learned a lot. It was really, really hard. But I learned a lot. That's really where I cut my teeth and understood margins, marketing, distribution, brand. And I really have to credit that experience with kind of preparing me for what I'm doing now.
You know, you use the phrase CPG. Can you explain what that is for someone who's never heard the term?
Sure. So CPG is an acronym that stands for Consumer Packaged Goods. Anything that is in a box. You go to the grocery store, you buy a box of cereal, that is a CPG product. You go to Sephora, you buy a lipstick that's in a box, that is a CPG product. So consumer is the other term that's used. It's essentially products that we buy, right? So in other words, a car is not really CPG because it doesn't come in a box. Going to the salon and getting your haircut, that is not CPG. It's not a product in a box that someone scans a barcode. If there is a barcode on it, it's in a box, that is CPG, otherwise known as the consumer space.
Great. And you enter this consumer space very different from what you were doing at Columbia, very different from what you were doing with Pistolera. What were some of those lessons you're learning day to day on the job?
I would say the biggest lesson that I learned from that experience was you have to understand your category and you have to have a strong understanding of the financials and the cash flow for your specific, you know, industry, as well as the distribution costs involved with actually building a brand. Because no one at the company that I was working for, they also didn't know. It was their first time as well. And we made a lot of costly mistakes. There's a lot we didn't know. And so much so that after that experience, I ended up becoming a consultant and teaching a class to emerging CPG founders to help them navigate and make sure they didn't make the same mistakes.
So what I'm hearing is you kind of make this pretty very successful pivot, it appears like, from a successful music career. Now you're in the CPG space. But then 2019 comes in, and I'm guessing you didn't see this coming, but you lose your job. Take me through that.
Yeah, so I was working for this beverage brand, the CPG startup brand, in the beverage space, which is extremely brutal, right? Out of all of the categories, beverage is one of the most competitive and just such a low margin. You're selling things for $2, $3, right? You think of the drinks that you buy at the store. And it was a family business. I was not in the family. It was not my family. But it was a family business that imploded. So the family kind of, you know, fell apart. And therefore, we all kind of lost our jobs. It's not like I got fired. Just the business fell apart. And so all of a sudden, here I am. No savings, no backup plan. And I found myself unemployed in the summer of 2019. And that was a really tough moment for me because I had never been unemployed in my life.
And one thing you left out is you also had a daughter. You still have a daughter. and you had loans as well?
Yes. So my daughter at that time was 13. And I had student loans. I still have them from back when I went to NYU to get my master's. And it's a combination of having a child, having the student loan debt, and then having no savings that really was like a real low point for me in my life. Also, because I think it's worth noting that at that time, I'm in my 40s. So I'm feeling very bad about my life. And how did I get here? I feel like I should have more to show for everything I've done, and I didn't.
And I think that's a sentiment a lot of us can relate to. And I think you do something that a lot of us probably do when we hit our lowest points. You go home and you visit your parents. What happens on that trip to San Diego?
So here I am unemployed. I'm visiting, have my daughter with me to visit her grandparents. I'm in San Diego. And I'm like, well, the good thing is I have time off. So I'm with my daughter. Let me try to enjoy a little bit and let's learn how to like make stuff this summer. I didn't want to ruin her summer. Even though I was panicking inside, I didn't want my daughter to know that I was panicking. And so we learned how to make lotion bars and I was learning how to make soap. And that's kind of where this whole journey began that I'm in now is my parents, like everyone in San Diego, has a nopalera in their front yard. And, you know, I was learning how to make soap and there was a recipe for aloe vera soap. I didn't have any aloe vera, but I was like, well, nopales, that's close enough. Let me just substitute it. And that's, you know, that was kind of the light bulb moment.
I love that. So the answer to your next chapter was in your parents' garden, I imagine, or front yard. And so you have this idea of like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like I could make soaps based out of cactus. But my big question is you lost your job. You have a daughter. You have debt. What in that moment registered as, you know what? This is the time to launch a business.
I know it seems counterintuitive, but we all have those moments in our life, or maybe we don't. Maybe not everyone does. But the thing is, if you are comfortable in your life, you are not compelled to make a change. If you like where you live, you like your house, you're getting a good paycheck, even if you have ideas to do other things, you're like, well, why would I ruin what I have right now? I have a steady job, there's food in the fridge, bills are paid. Even if you have a brilliant idea, you might not pursue it because you're comfortable. And as we know, a lot of innovation comes from there being a problem. Right? There is a problem that needs to be solved, and that is what makes you think creatively and outside of the box. And that's really what that moment was. Like, here I am, I can either continue to do what I've been doing, which got me here, or I can think outside of the box and I can actually think bigger. And this might be the opportunity to go and build something. Because again, if I had not lost my job, Fernando, I would have never started Nopalera.
So now you have this idea that you're super excited about. You go back to New York and you say, okay, I'm going to do this. How do you fund this? How do you buy the first thing you have to buy? And what is that first thing, that first step you take to launch Nopalera officially?
Yeah, so the first steps actually happened while I was still in San Diego at my parents' house. I had the idea. I literally was like, here's this plant I've known my whole life. I'm going to name the brand after this culturally symbolic plant that is also sustainable and nourishing and versatile. It's going to be called Nopalera. Like, I knew that right away. I'm like, I'm going to start a beauty brand. It's going to be called Nopalera. It's going to be a high-end beauty brand. So the first thing I did was buy the URL and the trademark. So I did that for my laptop on my credit card. And the reason that to this day, why our website is nopalera.co and not .com is because someone had already bought nopalera.com. And so those were the first things that I bought. The third thing that I bought was enrollment into a formulation school. Because I'm like, I don't know how to make beauty products. I don't have any connections in the beauty industry. I'm going to have to make this myself. And so I found a formulation school that's based in the UK called Formula Botanica. And I studied with them. Again, on my credit card, enroll for the payment plan. Anything that could be on a payment plan and accepts credit cards is what I did. And studied for 9 months. And then the fourth thing that I did was call my friend who is a designer, a brilliant designer. I said, listen, I'm going to start a premium Latina beauty brand and I want you to be the person that does the branding. The only thing is I don't have any money. So can we do a payment plan? And luckily she said yes. So everything, all of Nopalera was built on a payment plan with my credit card.
I feel like I need to see a picture of this credit card without the numbers, but I think this credit card played a big role in the launch of your business. How much would you estimate if you take away the payment plans and the lump sum that you were needed to invest in those first four steps that you just mentioned, what value would you put on that?
So when I added up all of the initial launch costs, so not just those things that I mentioned, but then I had to buy ingredients, then I had to figure out how to get packaging made. At the end of it all, it was $25,000. And that included, that was like the branding, the ingredients, the boxes. It was like to get it, to make it go live and actually have products to sell. That's what it ended up being. And I didn't have $25,000, obviously. I paid it over a course of like a year and a half.
And all of that was on that credit card?
Yes.
Wow. Did you ever think like, oh man, if this goes south, like what was the worst case scenario in your head with that credit card?
Honestly, because I've had debt my whole life, I was not scared. I was like, I know that I can pay off debt like in little increments, bite-sized increments, 1 month at a time. You know, worst thing is that it's going to accumulate interest, but I've had them, again, I've done them my whole adult life.
I love what you said in another interview. You said, I didn't start Nopalera because I like soap. So can you elaborate on kind of what your thought process was for creating a beauty skincare line as opposed to, food line or some other product?
Every celebrity that starts a brand is a beauty brand. And the reason for that is the margins in beauty are better. The food and beverage industry, the margins are horrible. It is brutal. Like, again, I worked in beverage. You know, you're selling a drink for $3. How many drinks do you think you have to sell to become a $10 million company, right? In beauty, you know, the cost of goods, you know, is, you know, if you sell something for $10, it should cost you less than $2 to make. And so for me, the reason I said that I didn't start the company because I like soap is because for me, it was about the mission. The mission was to build a premium Latina brand that would disrupt the Eurocentric beauty space, which has been dominated by Western European brands. All of us have been conditioned to believe if it's French, it's more worthy of a higher price tag, it's more expensive, it's a higher quality. And if it's Mexican, it should be cheap, it should be, you know, of value. And so that was what I was fighting against. And that's why we exist. Like, there's plenty of soap in the world, you know what I mean? But our brand and what we stand for, we have a brand. A brand is not a product, a brand is a feeling. And that is why people have rallied around our brand, because of what it stands for. Because, you know, me even having the audacity to build this kind of brand already speaks volumes.
And now you have all this momentum. You eventually need to start making the soap, your product. Where do you make the soap?
In my kitchen. So the first Nopalera soaps were made in my kitchen. And I quickly outgrew my kitchen. So then I had to find like a basement studio, which was really not a real commercial space. It's New York. So there's a lot of like not real commercial spaces happening. It was really a basement apartment that I found. That used to be like a tax office. And that is where I had to move into to kind of scale.
And I read another thing that I also loved. I think you said, I wasn't making it in my kitchen because I wanted to be this like boho homemade brand. That's just kind of what you had to do.
I literally didn't even know how to find someone to make it for me. Yeah.
And what's also, what I want to point out too, is you weren't just, you know, burning money. You were also still working at this time, and you were working with Van Leeuwen, which is an artisan ice cream company at the time. What were you doing for Van Leeuwen then?
For Van Leeuwen, I was a territory manager. So I was managing, I was selling into accounts. I was managing merchandisers. I was basically in sales. So it allowed me the opportunity to be in stores and kind of see what was on the shelf. You know, I was going into Whole Foods a lot. And just reinforced, like, I'm seeing no Latino brands on the shelf, none. A lot in food, right? Plenty of Latino brands in food, but in beauty, and I'm seeing plenty of African heritage-inspired brands in beauty. I'm seeing Alafia, Nubian Heritage, Shea Moisture, et cetera. And I'm like, and where are the Latino beauty brands?
So there was a space and a market, you thought, for this. So take me to November of 2020, which is when you launch. What was the lead up to that launch, and what elements did you put into place to say, all right, we are good to go, let's start selling some product?
So there was a couple things that I did. I knew I worked on the branding for a year. So that's really important, because I knew that in beauty, which is an aspirational category, the branding was going to make or break it. So really tweaking like what you now see today, that was just one option. You know, there were four other directions that we didn't go with. The other thing I did was I started to build the community in advance. So I started to run Facebook ads really early. As soon as I had my logo, what we call the Cactus Goddess, I started to run those. This has all changed, right? So back then, you could send targeted ads. In other words, show this logo to women that live in Texas, in California, in Chicago, who are between these ages, who like these four things, right? Sephora, dancing, traveling, human rights, as an example. And that allowed me to build an email list of 800 people. And I didn't even have a product to show them. People were literally signing up just based off of the logo. Me saying like, you know, Mexican Botanicals for Bath and Body, coming soon, sign up to get notified. And so that built an email list of 800 people. And the way that the algorithm worked then was that once you got 100 people to take an action, Facebook would find you 100 more people just like them. And so it was a little bit of a snowball back then to kind of build this list so that when I did launch, and that was like 4 months before launch, I was trying to build this email list. And then when I did launch, I had someone to launch to, right? So that was one strategy that I'm really glad I did, because now the marketing landscape has really changed. You cannot target people anymore, right? When you open your phone and it says, ask app not to track, that's that, right?
Oh, I got to apologize now because I've done that a few times. So you have this, what I think is a brilliant strategy. You build a community, then you launch the product. What was that reception once you're ready to start shipping out the soap?
The response was everything that I hoped and dreamed for. I mean, it was like a magnet. The day I turned on the website, orders came. And I was like, how are these people even, like a wholesale inquiries, like boutiques, like, oh, do you sell wholesale? I was like, what? Wait, what? Yes, I think so. So it was exciting, but also stressful because I was still making the soap. So that was hard to keep up with. And that's when I had to hire assistants. And then all of a sudden I'm running a soap studio. So now I have two people, you know, pouring soap with me that I had to train. And, you know, soap is a chemical process. This is not like for kids. It's chemistry to make soap. So that was interesting. And I was furiously trying to find manufacturing partners that could take this off of my hands, because I'm also running the social media. I'm still working for Van Leeuwen, right? And I'm trying to get these orders, you know, through, trying to figure out Shopify. So it was a lot.
And that first year you sell 19,000?
So when I say the first year, we're talking about November and December, right? So yeah. 2020, there was only 2 months. So yeah, it was like $19,000 for those 2 months.
But not bad for you know, starting that way. And in 2021, you fully surpassed that. And we'll get into that in a bit. But before we do that, I want other people to ask you two questions. So those questions are actually coming from Comcast Rise Award recipients. Comcast Rise, just so you know, supports the growth of all small businesses and individuals committed to uplifting their communities. And Rise has awarded more than $125 million in monetary, marketing, and technology grants to businesses all over the United States. And our first question is from the founder of a stock market education company. So let's hear that question.
Hi, I'm Jason Brown, stock market coach and option trader and founder of the BrownReport.com, a stock market education company. Being an entrepreneur is very mentally taxing. And so what are some of the things that you've either done in the past or that you currently do to take care of your mental health? Because we all know that entrepreneurs deal with employees, team, the vision of the company. If you're married or have a family, that's another weight or pressure that's on you. And so what are some of the things that you do to take care of your mental health while you're building your business and while you're trying to move forward and stay profitable in an environment that's constantly changing?
Taking care of your mental health as an entrepreneur is actually one of the most important things when you are starting, because everything is on your shoulders. And if you as a founder burn out, the whole company goes with you. So it is very important to take care of your mental health. I do it by simply making sure that I sleep 8 hours every day and that I surround myself with people who want to see me win. And that doesn't mean yes men, you know, it's not that. It's that you do have to be around people who understand what you're trying to do. Right. So I had to get new friends when I started No Paleta, because I needed to be around other entrepreneurs. So sleeping and eating, honestly, it's so basic because a lot of entrepreneurs lose sleep, and sleep deprivation is honestly a form of torture. So those basic things is what I do. And that is honestly what keeps me sane. Because if I don't eat and I don't sleep, then I can't make decisions. I can't be creative. I can't be talking to you right now. So that's what I do. It's not fancy. It's really, really basic.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
All right. Our final question is from the founder of Psychometric Solutions, which describes itself as a culturally sensitive research company. Let's hear the question.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tamika L. Payton, the founder and CEO of Psychometric Solutions. We are all excited about a new product that we're looking to launch very soon. However, I have prolonged the launch date quite a few times. For reasons that I can rationalize, yet I'm starting to believe I could be overthinking it. What are the primary factors I should consider as a CEO when deciding on a new and final launch date?
If you're about to launch a product for the first time, or company for the first time, you want to make sure that your product is kind of ready to go to market. You know, that you're not rushing to launch. Number one, that you have a very clear vision of why this product, this brand, this company needs to exist and who it is for. Otherwise, you're going to launch and throw spaghetti at the wall and hope that someone buys it, gets it. So really, really being clear and sitting down and writing out your brand values and mission and why, like you're writing a Bible, is what I did. Because it, you know, as you proceed, that is what's going to guide you. You know, so you need to make sure that you don't rush a launch.
Great. Thank you to those two businesses for sending in those questions. I want to go back to your story now, Sandra. I'm really curious about how one decides the price of a product. So take me with one of your soaps, for instance, that you launched with. How did you decide how much it was going to cost?
Yeah, you decide how much something's going to cost, first and foremost, because of how much it costs you to make. So when you are selling products, the only way that you make money as a business and survive is if you sell something for a lot more than it costs you to make. And this is something that I think new for maybe first-time founders struggle with because they're scared that people won't buy it if they price it too high, and then they end up having no margin left over to actually grow their business. So it's, first of all, COGS, cost of goods sold. How much does it cost you to make? Number two, and the reason is because, again, what is your vision for this brand? Where are you going to take it? If you're going to sell it wholesale, they're going to take a 50 margin. So if you're trying to sell, when I sell a soap for $14 on my website, I sell that soap for $7 to Nordstrom, right? Because Nordstrom, when they sell it for $14, they're going to make $7 off of that. Okay, so understanding if you're going to sell it wholesale, you need to make sure you build in the wholesale margin into your calculation. Number two is your positioning. I think a great example is the fragrance category. When someone is buying a Chanel perfume, do you really think it costs more than to make a Chanel perfume than it costs to make, you know, like a, I don't know, a Glossier perfume? No, it's the positioning, right? People are buying the brand. Maybe it's heavy, maybe it's glass, maybe it's stone, whatever it is. So it's positioning as well. Like, what experience are you trying to create for your customer? And where do you anticipate your product living? In what stores? Like, you have to think about, where do I want to sell this?
And you had a moment with the pricing. And at one point, a customer comment on Instagram, I imagine this was in response to a picture of a soap or somewhere on your post, said, quote, $14 for a 4-ounce bar of soap? ! Mexican owned, but not Mexican prices, end quote. You responded with a post that went pretty viral. What was in that post?
Yeah, the post just said, and honestly, I remember when that comment came in, I was on vacation. So it was very relaxed. Didn't really faze me. I was like, let me just throw together a response here. And it said, made with Mexican hands does not equal cheap. And that post went viral. That response went viral. And again, those moments are where you get to stand in your brand values. Because the people that think that this bar of soap is too expensive are not our customers. So I don't care what they think. But the people that do love the brand and what we stand for, they rally behind us because we stand up for ourselves. And that's ultimately what we're about. You know, we are about self-worth.
And earlier you said you closed out 2020, which was your first year of launch, which really only meant 2 months, November to December, with 19,000 in sales. 2021 becomes a totally different story. How much do you sell that year?
We sell over 500,000. So we do over 500,000 in sales in 2021, which far exceeded my expectations. Again, I'm starting with $0 when I'm doing this. And so it was great, but again, also stressful because I'm trying to keep up with demand and I'm hand pouring soap, you know, and my boyfriend is my shipping manager. So everything is super DIY, you know, and nobody knows it. Nordstrom didn't know it. It was stressful.
Let's talk about Nordstrom there. How do you end up in Nordstrom stores in 2021?
Well, on the first day of launch, taking it back to November 2020, Beauty Independent launched an article about the brand with a picture. And from there, all of a sudden, people started to find me. And one of those people was my now VP of sales, Priscilla, who reached out and said, I'm Latina. You know, I have 18 years of experience in like luxury goods sales. I'm building my own sales agency, and I'd love to bring you on as a client. And so she started working as like on a commission basis. She was my first kind of employee, or not really an employee because she was just commission based. But she is the one that reached out to Nordstrom on my behalf, and also was managing all these wholesale boutiques. Like we had like 250 boutiques like by the end of the first year. So it was a lot. I couldn't do it myself, even though I thought I was going to, because I was like, I work in sales, I'll manage it myself. But thank God I didn't, because it's too much.
And by the end of 2021, what is your role looking like with Nopalera? I hope and I think very different from what it was looking like in the lead up to launch.
Yeah, so I'm still at the end of 2021. Some things I did get off my plate. So I finally found a manufacturing partner that would take over my formulas. That was a huge relief. I also finally found a warehouse that would ship my products, also a huge relief. So those were big milestones for me because it got stuff out of my house. But I was still doing too much. You know, there's still so much to be done. You know, who's doing your bookkeeping? Who's doing your socials? Who's customer support, right? I was still, my boyfriend was my customer support. And that's like the least thing that you should be doing. So there's still a lot, you know, that goes into running a business day to day. And when things are moving so quickly, it's really easy to get to drowned.
And now I have to address the elephant in the room or the shark in the room. How do you end up on Shark Tank?
So another friend of mine, another Latina friend of mine, actually, her and I were talking, and she's a founder as well. And she said, you know, you should apply to Shark Tank. And I was like, what? Why? I don't really have time for that. Those deals are not so great. She was like, no, you should just do it. See what happens. It's whatever happens, it's good. It's good exposure for your brand. And I was like, okay. So I just went to the website, just like Googled Shark Tank application, found the website, applied. And then I got a call back and they were like, we're interested to hear more about your brand. And that kind of set off a whole, like, I don't know, several months of vetting and hoops that you have to jump through and auditions and audition tapes and everything. So it was a very long lead up process.
And take us through that shoot day. What is the day when you go to the studio and talk to the sharks? What is that day like?
There's a lot of hurry up and wait. So, you know, it's a very early call time. And remember, this is during COVID. So we all had to get COVID tested. We had to quarantine in our hotels, you know, So there's that aspect. And it was actually on my birthday. So I spent my birthday alone in a hotel in LA because Shark Tank was being filmed the next day. And you get taken to the studio, you get put into a green room, you know, to hair and makeup. And there's no schedule. Like, they don't tell you what time you're going to be on, because there's actually no time limit to how long you can be in the tank. Some people are in there for 20 minutes. Some people are in there for an hour and a half. It really just depends. And so all I knew was that I wasn't first. And I was actually more towards the end of the day. So you get put into one green room. And then when it's like closer to your turn, then you get put into another green room that's actually close to the stage. You're not allowed to bring your phone. There's no clock. So I have no idea what time I went in, what time I came out. I didn't have my phone. There's no pictures allowed, et cetera. And then all of a sudden it's like go time. They're like, okay, they put you in your spot. You walk out, you know, on the runway, and they open the doors and it's go time. And one thing that I didn't anticipate, or one thing that nobody warned me about, is that it's a dead quiet soundstage. And, you know, when you see Shark Tank on TV, it's edited, there's music, it's dramatic. But in real life, everyone has to bring that energy and bring that drama, because you're just in a quiet room.
And after that, you end up rejecting the offers from the Sharks. But I imagine there's a lot of good that comes from the exposure that show brings. So your episode airs 2023. What happened after that airs on national television?
Yeah, so, you know, I got two offers. They wanted way too much equity, so I turned them down. What the offer was $300,000 for 30% of the company, right? That was what they were offering me. And what we ended up doing, or what ended up happening after the episode, is we ended up making $300,000 in sales anyway, without having to give up the 30% equity. So half of the orders came to our website, the other half went to Amazon. So it was like 6,000 orders in total in 2 weeks.
And what was the prep like for going to Shark Tank? Like, how do you project what could happen, and what kind of communication do you need to have ready to send out to customers, and what education do you need on your... I think there's so many variables that you need to take care of to be prepared for the influx, hopefully, of customers that comes in.
Yeah, I think... Here's the thing, is that they only give you 3 weeks' notice. So you kind of have to be ready anyway, you know? And I filmed in July of 2022, and it didn't air until January of 2023. So, you know, I'm waiting for months and months and months, like, for the email that that's going to say your episode's going to air. I thought it was going to air in 2022, and it didn't. And so we were already ready. You know, we were getting ourselves ready. And then literally right after New Year's, I get an email like, okay, congratulations, your episode's going to air. Because the other thing to note is that people film and not everyone's episode airs, which is really sad because it's a lot of work. So we were ready and we prepared. We kicked the tires. We're like, alert the warehouse. Is customer support ready? Like, is the bundle ready? Is everything, you know, check this, check that, stress test it, because we're about to get flooded. And that's what happened. But we were ready. Because we had been planning it, you know, I was like, this episode is going to air. It's going to happen. I just don't know when.
I love it. Well, I'm glad that it aired. I didn't know that. I guess it makes sense that they shoot some and some of them just don't make the cut. So at this point now, speaking currently, you've been named a Latino Startup of the Year by Latitude Ventures. You've been in Shark Tank. You're in Nordstrom, Free People, and 350 other plus stockists and retail locations. What's next for Nopalera?
What's next is that we are looking to partner with a national beauty retailer. So hopefully it's Ulta. That would really be, we've asked our customers where they shop, and they shop at Ulta. And that's really what's next in terms of really scaling our brand. And we're also talking to some international distributors that are interested in our brand as well. But, you know, in terms of hometown or home territory, we really need a beauty retailer to scale.
And I was listening to another interview that you did. You've experimented with pop-ups as well. What lessons did you learn from that?
We had a pop-up in Los Angeles at the end of last year. And what we learned is that it's a lot of work. But also, it's great when you have a brand like ours that is just so rich, so colorful, so tactile. Like, people want to experience it in person. And we did actually 17 events last year, which was a lot. But people want to meet us. They want to feel the brand. They want to see the brand. What I learned is that you need to find good, cheap rent, because some days are going to be slow, you know, and when you're doing a pop-up, you're paying more expensive rent because you haven't signed like a year lease, you know? So the rent was high. If we had had cheaper rent, it would have been better for us. But that was as cheap as we could find in a good area.
And now, before we get into our trademark business 101 section, I have to ask, where is that credit card that you used so loyally at the beginning of your Nopalera journey?
I think it's in my wallet.
Does it still
it's
get
my
some
American
good swipes?
Express. It's okay. My American Express. Yeah, I think I've maybe had to like get new ones because they get old and the numbers rub off. But yeah.
Nice. It's still with you. All right. Now we're going to go into our section that we call Business 101. Kind of rapid fire, mm-hmm. but feel free to take your time answering them. There's no timer. My first question for you is, Sandra, what is your earliest money memory?
My earliest money memory is that my mother used to travel a lot when I was a child, and she would bring us like coins or like dollar bills from other countries. So that's really what I think of in terms of like a memory that was memorable.
If you had a business school course or business school, what would it be called? So it'd be Sandra 101 :
It would be called cash flow management.
Why do you say that?
Because if, you know, assuming this is the course for business or entrepreneurs, understanding cash flow management is critical to your survival. There's so many other, everyone wants to talk about branding and marketing and Shark Tank and Nordstrom. But if you do not have a solid financial model, it doesn't matter. So like financial modeling is one of those skills that I had to learn building Nopalera. And it's like a critical component that people don't talk about enough because everyone wants to talk about the fun stuff.
What's the worst business advice you've received?
The worst business advice I've received is to look at what the strategics are missing and build a brand towards that. And that piece of advice actually came from someone very reputable. But when I think about it, when I've talked to other experts that I respect, they're like, that's a terrible idea. Because then you're not really building a brand that you want to build. You're building for something that you think like Estee Lauder might want in 10 years. And that could change. Like, who knows? Like, the you know, trends are always changing. So build a brand that you believe in, that you want to build, is the way that you should go.
Kind of in that similar vein, what is that best advice you've received?
The best advice I have, did I receive it? I read it in a book, and it's actually the best piece of advice that I give to others, which is to begin with the end in mind. That means, how does this end? What is the end goal? What do you really want to achieve with this? And then work backwards to make that happen. So for Nopalera, I'm building an aspirational Latina brand that I wanted it to sit on premium store shelves. So what does that brand need to look like? What does it need to feel like? What does the price need to be? What do I want people to feel when they see the brand? All of that was intentional. You know, when people see Nopalera and they're like, oh my God, I love your branding. I'm like, I know, it's good, right? That's on purpose. That was not an accident, right? There are no accidents here. This was on purpose. So do things on purpose based off of where you want to go.
And this last question, I think you're one of the best people to ask this because you have the Nopalera podcast, which if I don't want to logline it for you, but I think this is kind of how you logline it too. It's kind of a journal meets also a podcast where you interview other people who are making waves in their respective industries, but you also share a lot of trials and tribulations that you've had yourself with Nopalera, which if you're an entrepreneur, I think that's a great resource to see the day-to-day of how you build a business. So my question to you is, who else should we have as a guest lecturer or a guest on business school and why?
I think that you should definitely have guest women of color investors to really get their perspective on what is their life like? What are they looking for? What does that mean when they invest money? Where does the money come from? You know, there's the other side of the table, right? Like, you could talk to founders about raising money, but you need to hear the other side of the story. And that will also help founders understand how to communicate to these people, you know, because they are often, you know, if anyone doesn't know, the VCs are not the people with the money. The VCs are the people that know the people with the money. They have to go out and raise money just like we do. You know, they're always fundraising. They're always raising their next fund, $40 million fund, $100 million fund. And so it's a hard life, you know? So I think understanding their anxieties and what they're looking for and their perspective is super valuable.
All right. Well, Sandra, that wraps it up for us. Thank you so much for stopping by Business School.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Fernando. If you like this episode, go back and subscribe to get notified when new episodes drop. And if you really, really like the episode, make sure to leave a review. It helps others find the most affordable business school out there right now, Business School. Thanks for listening.